Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 20, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking through the most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got the usual two segments lined up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Charlie Komenoff, the energy consultant and all-around big thinker about issues relating to transportation, to talk about a new souped-up version of Mayor Bloomberg's congestion pricing plan that would jack up those fees a bit, but in return, give us free subways and buses and many, many other benefits. We'll hear from Charlie about that scheme in a few minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded earlier this week with Adolf Reed, professor of political science and columnist at the University of Pennsylvania and columnist for the Progressive magazine, talking about why he has no Democratic candidate this year and why the whatever neoliberal weasel, as he puts it, gets the party's nomination. He's going to sit this one out. Adolf, always provocative and intelligent, is certainly in this interview, he is both those things. And before we get to all that, just some observations on the current economic scene. Another day and another few billion in write-offs. It's becoming pretty routine news now in the financial markets that some brand-name bank or other announces huge write-offs, which is the way accountants say, admits to giant losses in mortgage-backed securities. Today, Bear Stearns, which has a reputation as being scrappy and aggressive, fessed up to almost $2 billion in losses, which more than wiped out its profits for the quarter, yielding the bank's first loss in its 84-year history. Yesterday, Morgan Stanley, which has a reputation for being smart and aristocratic, announced write-offs of almost $10 billion, a very giant number, far more than anyone expected, resulting in the first loss in that firm's 70-plus year history. As has become almost customary now, Morgan Stanley also announced that it was getting a capital infusion from China to the tune of $5 billion. Bear Stearns announced one of those a while back. More recently, of course, Citigroup got a cash infusion from Abu Dhabi's state investment fund. Following the announcement of the Chinese infusion into Morgan Stanley, true to his party's Sinophobic form, Senate Banking Committee Chair Christopher Dodd, who's also an obscure Democratic candidate for president, wondered aloud whether there were national security issues involved. This is rich indeed, given how the U.S. is always lecturing foreign countries on their need to be open to foreign investment, especially when it comes from the U.S. Do as I say, not as I do. Since the U.S. has been running huge trade deficits for years on end now, vast hordes of dollars have accumulated abroad in the coffers of exporters of industrial goods like China and exporters of oil like Abu Dhabi. In the old days, countries simply parked these cash reserves in U.S. Treasury bills and bonds. But those are boring old securities that merely pay modest interest rates. Lately, many countries have been endowing so-called sovereign wealth funds, which are giant, and I do mean giant, to the tune of hundreds of billions or even approaching $1 trillion. These are giant pools of capital, lusting for yields higher than the 4% you can get from the U.S. Treasury. And given the way the dollar's value has been sinking relative to other currencies, foreign investors are ending up in the red after you make the necessary adjustments for currency value, so they're not even getting that 4%. So these sovereign wealth funds have been looking for pieces of more lucrative assets than tedious bonds bearing Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson's signature. They've been taking advantage of Wall Street's subprime distress by buying chunks ranging from 2 to 10% of banks that need capital infusions after taking big mortgage hits. This is getting interesting from a political point of view. According to classic theories like those of Hobson and Lenin, imperialist countries are characterized by the ownership of large foreign assets. Britain was the biggest one of those in the 19th and early 20th centuries until it was surpassed by the U.S., first after World War I, and then definitively after World War II. The U.S. was then the world's biggest international creditor until its foreign accounts started eroding in the 1970s. The erosion accelerated in the 1980s and accelerated further in the early 2000s as the U.S. tapped foreign capital in huge quantities to fund our mortgage bubble. Our net debt to the outside world, which was was 18% of GDP in 2000. It's now more than twice that, 37% of GDP. So according to the classic theories of imperialism I mentioned, the U.S. is no longer the top dog. We've become, in financial terms, a subordinate country. Except that we haven't really, at least not yet. The U.S. military and political power is still formidable, although it looks a lot less so now than it did before the invasion of Iraq. But defenders of U.S. power, and not in the moral sense, but in the factual sense, could always say that the net debt position really seemed to have no serious political consequences, and so U.S. imperial power remained intact. It's getting harder to market that argument now, as Asian and Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds pick up some of our choice national assets. So what does this all mean? Has the erosion of U.S. economic dominance entered a new phase, or can the U.S., with, say, some sort of homegrown austerity program imposed by a President Clinton or Obama, get its financial act back together again? Is the rise of China a mirage, or is it something substantial, putting China in the same relation to the U.S. that the U.S. was to Britain almost 100 years ago when the top dog baton was being passed? I wish I could provide a firm answer to that question, but I can't. So as the pundits say, it's too early to tell. But the fact is that we can seriously ask this question really does mean something, doesn't it? And a footnote on China. The other week, the Conference Board, the business finance think tank, released a couple of reports on the Chinese economy. One of them estimated that productivity growth in China from 1995 to 2005 averaged 20% a year. That is a phenomenal number, nearly 10 times the long-term U.S. average, and about 4 or 5 times what we manage in a good year. Sometimes China looks like an economic, political, and ecological accident waiting to happen. But then you see a number like that, and you can only say, gee whiz. Gee whiz. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Charlie Kominoff. And that was an excerpt from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 27 in E minor, a second movement performed by Alfred Brendel. We don't really know when Beethoven's birthday was, but his baptism day was December 17, 1770. And so we presume his birthday was shortly before that. So happy was 238th, Ludwig?
237.
yes, right. And he did die at the tender age of 55, which is just how old I am, so let's not dwell on that. We're now joined in the studio by Charlie Kominoff, who is an economic consultant and environmental expert, frequent guest here on Behind the News to bash the automobile. And he was the research guy on a study that is being released by Nurture New York's Nature. Is that
yes? That's Ted Keel's environmental organization, Nurture New York's Nature.
Yeah. So I want to get to this in a second, but let's just start by and ask you a general question. What do you make of Mayor Bloomberg's green credibility?
There's a lot of great talk, and I mean that seriously. In the past 2 months, the mayor has given at least 2 major addresses: one in Seattle and another last week in Bali at the UN climate conference, calling for a carbon tax. And as the co-founder and co-director of the Carbon Tax Center, I am required and very willing to say that a carbon tax is the sine qua non of any progress on reducing CO2 emissions and dealing with the climate crisis. And to see Mayor Bloomberg ardently and unequivocally call for putting a price on carbon and not through the subject to manipulation cap and trade system that too many of the big green groups are touting, but through a straight up carbon tax is terrific. And on Earth Day earlier this year, when he released his Plan YC with the congestion pricing proposal, that too is terrific. And the only the fact that I'm here with you talking about a plan that would go beyond Mayor Bloomberg's congestion pricing proposal, well, let's step back and give credit to the guy who opened the door, which is the mayor.
And I was amazed to see the quote from the mayor that opens this preliminary version of the Keel Report here is if you were to design the ultimate system, you would have mass transit be free and charge an enormous amount for cars. The mayor said that April 20th, 2007. I wasn't aware he'd said that, but that is quite amazing coming from a big bourgeois politician like him. Isn't it?
Well, he's also an efficiency expert. And I think that the mayor made that statement not on moral grounds, but on pragmatic grounds, that things work better for the vast majority of people when the automobile is charged a considerable fee to be driven into very congested parts of the city, which happen to be the parts that have the best mass transit options, and when mass transit itself is either stabilized in price, cut in price, or has its price eliminated completely. So that statement by the mayor, although heartening and revolutionary, in some sense it's not all that surprising.
All right, let's get to this report. Now, Theodore Keel is a name I've heard for as long as I can remember, just as a sort of a very establishment lawyer, member of what sometimes is called the permanent government, it seems. So tell us about him and this report and how it came to be.
Well, in some ways it's tempting to look at Theodore Keel as the Clark Clifford of New York City, the brilliant corporate lawyer, the fixer, the man who knows everybody and the person who can enter into a chaotic situation and set everything straight and come up with a solution. And he has been that. But at the same time, he's been something very different and very special, which is an ardent advocate for public transportation in New York City. And there are two fronts of Keel's activism in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that are particularly noteworthy.
How old is he? He's been around forever.
He is 93 years old.
Wow.
And, still out there and, kicking, as evidenced by the fact that he's funded and is out there in front and pushing this study or this plan, which we've dubbed. He didn't dub it. We've dubbed it. Those of us working on it have dubbed the Keel Plan. But in the 60s, Ted was the first prominent person to call for increasing tolls on cars and trucks on bridges and tunnels and dedicating that money to mass transit. It's kind of second nature now. That was the basis of Rockefeller forging the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, in the late 1960s, where he combined Robert Moses' Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority with the moribund and failing transit system, and that infused money into transit and at least made some sort of maintenance and ultimately recovery of the transit system possible. So what we take as second nature now is actually very heretical and revolutionary in the 60s, and Keel was the first person to be urging that.
Before we proceed, I would like to make something clear, which is something you've emphasized as many times we've talked, but something a lot of people often forget. The cost of driving a car is nowhere near fully reflected in the amount of money you pay to run it. Tell us about the unrecognized, uninternalized cost of driving.
Right, the unpriced cost of driving into the city, which is sort of connected to the idea of the false consciousness of the motorist, which is something endemic in this country, the idea of the beleaguered driver who is taxed and tolled and charged, coming and going with tolls and parking fees and tickets and gas taxes and maybe someday carbon taxes. How much more can the poor beleaguered driver take? Well, a heck of a lot more when you consider that all these fees add up to only a fraction of the costs that the driver is actually imposing upon the environment, upon society, upon pedestrians and cyclists, and even on other drivers through the sheer space that drivers take up on the streets and roads, which prevents other drivers as well as other human beings from getting around.
As the as they say, you're not in traffic, you are traffic, right? So give us an idea of some of these costs. I mean, how much what portion do motorists actually bear of the kind of costs that they impose on us?
Well, if we just look at the fiscal costs, you know, forget the awful, deadening and maddening delays of traffic congestion. Again, not just drivers on other drivers or on themselves, but on people trying to get around, people trying to cross the street. Forget that. Forget the air pollution. Forget the carbon pollution, the noise pollution, and all that stuff. And just look at the sheer fiscal costs. I did a study a dozen years ago for the Tri-State Transportation Campaign, which found that for every dollar of public services lavished on or spent on motorists to provide and maintain the roads and the court system for adjudicating crashes and all that stuff, that motorists only pay 65 cents. On that dollar. So there's a sort of a one-third subsidy. But then when you throw in all these kind of indirect or so-called externality costs, they're massive. And, you know, actually, Doug, I don't have those numbers at my fingertips. What I can tell you is that the fee to drive into the central part of Manhattan, the so-called Central Business District or CBD that is being proposed in the Keel plan, a $16 fee to drive in, nowhere near captures the full cost, as evidenced by the fact that if we made that cost even higher, if we priced it at $20 or $25, the net social benefits to New Yorkers would actually go up.
Yeah, well, you stole my next question from me, which was to give us the soundbite version of this proposal. So it starts with a $16. The mayor's proposing an $8 fee. Only some times of day, right?
Yeah, 12 hours of the day and only 5 days a week. So it's actually only covering 60 hours.
And how are you defining the Central Business District?
It's Manhattan south of 60th Street. So, yeah, you know, we could do a side-by-side comparison. Bloomberg's cordon area is a tiny bit larger than ours. He would only charge, again, those 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. We would charge all the time, although we're working on modifications where we would feather that cost down for off-peak times and charge much less, maybe even nothing in some variations during the graveyard shift. The mayor would have 340 charging locations because he would be charging car movements within the cordon and even to leave the Central Business District, although I think he's beginning to relinquish that idea. We would only need 19 charging locations, one on each avenue and maybe, I guess, two on some of the bridges and tunnels that lead into the Central Business District.
What about people who live in this area who have parked cars? Would they be subject to this tax?
They would not, at least under this first round. Now, you know, ultimately, Doug, we can imagine, and maybe it might be my utopia, somebody else's dystopia, a system where all vehicle movements would be charged and Hummers would pay more than little cars, and we would, you know, we might charge amounts outside of the Central Business District, obviously much less because congestion is less outside and the transit options aren't quite as terrific outside. So this is a first cut. It's not perfect, but the amazing thing about it is that if we did this $16 charge 24/7 to drive into the Central Business District, we would eliminate about a third of the auto trips that enter the Central Business District. We would improve traffic speeds within the heart of Manhattan by a third. And most important, we would have enough revenue to enable us to eliminate permanently all subway and bus fares in New York City, as well as commuter rail fares on trips taken entirely within New York City. So people getting on at Kingsbridge or Fordham Road or Nostrand Avenue in Brooklyn and coming into Penn Station or Grand Central would pay nothing, and ditto for the express buses as well. And the result would be that we would reduce traffic not only within the Central Business District or going to the Central Business District, but citywide, as some drivers change some of their trips to free buses and free subways. So this would be revolutionary in the psychology of the city, and it would be revolutionary in terms of destroying almost 10% of all the miles traveled in the city. We would really step back from the brink of overuse of the automobile and begin to move towards something more humane, more efficient, and more sustainable.
That's the voice of Charlie Komenoff, who is the research director for a study that was commissioned by Theodore Keel, which a bolder plan balancing free transit and congestion pricing in New York City. And this is an advanced version of a report that's going to be released in full next month, right?
Yes.
So I think a lot of people don't realize that there are costs to collecting fares, and it takes time. Tell us about what the benefits, aside from the fact that you don't have to pay $2 or whatever, what would the benefits would be of eliminating fare collection?
You know, probably the most fascinating soundbite from our study is that by having the buses free, they would go on average 20 to 25% faster simply by eliminating that maddening, not just the fumbling with the Metro card, you know, to put it into the card reader at the front of the bus, but people, passengers, could board anywhere. They would board at the back of the bus or the middle of the bus on the
And this doesn't even account the lesser traffic.
Exactly. This is simply if all traffic stayed the same, which of course it wouldn't, but simply by being able to board effectively. And this is the MTA's own number because they've done studies of systems in which you would have not free fare but rapid boarding, pre-boarding. So buses would go 23% faster. They would attract more riders. Waiting time would go down. And bus driver and bus system productivity would go up. Bus drivers would be happier because they wouldn't have to suffer that maddening wait themselves. So this is just one of dozens of aspects in which our city could be so much more efficient and humane under the Keel plan.
Now, how do you know how many trips would be reduced? I mean, there's this economic concept of elasticity, that people will do something more or less of something depending upon the price. What are your assumptions behind this idea?
Well, we don't know exactly, obviously, but there are three kinds of elasticities or sensitivities of travel to different factors. There's price elasticities, where if you make a certain mode of transport more expensive, people use it less. There are time elasticities, where if a certain way of getting around gets faster, more people will use it. And then there are even cross-elasticities that some of the new trips on the subways and buses will come at the expense of cars and vice versa. So we've cranked that all in based on studies that were done, frankly, several decades ago by this agency, the Tri-State Regional Planning Commission, that one of the people on the study team used to work for. But the heartening thing about the study is that you can change our input assumptions on these price elasticities and time elasticities. And sure, the bottom lines change somewhat as to how many trips would be eliminated and how much faster traffic could go. But the bottom line remains that huge amounts of time of all travelers would be saved. The time savings would be in the several billion dollars a year. And since we know that the price elasticities are less than one, which means if you raise the price to drive by, say, 20%, driving doesn't drop by 20%. It might drop by 10%. Revenues are going to increase under this plan, so we don't run the risk of killing the goose that's laying the golden egg. Congestion pricing is not going to sort of feed on itself. It's going to be a viable source of revenue, and under the Keel plan, it will produce more than enough revenue to finance free public transit in New York City.
And do you have any sense of how much time people spend in traffic in the city? How much time is wasted blowing horns and fighting gridlock?
Yeah, we do. do I have those numbers? The Partnership for the City of New York, which is the kind of blue ribbon business group that's backing the mayor's plan. And I should say, it's not only business that's backing the mayor's plan. There are, you know, liberal groups, progressives, some union groups like the Drum Major Institute, which are ardent backers of the mayor's congestion pricing plan. And we hope that they will come and push the stronger version, the bolder version, which is the Keel plan. But the New York City Partnership has estimated that $13 billion are lost every year in terms of the time that truckers, drivers, passengers, bus riders, et cetera, spend in traffic. We would, through the Keel plan, recover $4 billion of that lost time. So in effect, we would wipe out almost a third of the travel delays due to traffic gridlock in New York City simply by inaugurating and implementing this plan.
Now, this is one of those things, the cost that people don't think of when they think of the car. They think of just getting behind the wheel and zipping. You know, it's all free, it's all quick. But in fact, there are tremendous costs to the automobile, that time being one of them. But you've also enumerated some considerable benefits to health of people walking and cycling and less pollution. What other kinds of benefits would you get besides the less traffic?
You know, if this were 30 years ago, I would be touting the air pollution benefits from cutting down on all these car trips. But you know what? We got to be candid. Car tailpipe pollution is way down, you know, per tailpipe or per car from where it was a few decades ago. So the benefits, as I see them and as I've sort of, you know, added them up, of the reduced air pollution is only, if this is only, about a third of $1 billion per year. And the noise pollution benefits are maybe $100 or $200 billion a year. The fewer crashes, we'd save, you know, the public would save another $300 or $400 million a year. The biggest benefit from the Kiel plan, other than the time savings, which dwarf everything else, is the increased longevity of New Yorkers who will now have much greater opportunities to walk and ride bicycles because they won't be assailed and assaulted by quite as much motor traffic.
I got to say, I would ride a bicycle if it weren't so scary, but it's just there are too many maniacs out there that scare me.
Well, you know what, Doug? Not just scary, but just sort of unpleasant and stressful. Because, you know, I'm on a bike every day, as you know, and somehow I've just kind of gotten to where the risks don't seem to enter my mind. But I still feel that constant presence of motor traffic. And being able to have citywide traffic go down on average by 10% would make a difference to me and I think a million other people who either do or think about getting on a bike.
Now, of course, the standard objection to a lot of this is that this is not exactly limousine liberalism, but something like that. This is the proposal of a billionaire mayor for whom $16 is nothing, $8 is nothing. This is a proposal of an elite lawyer for whom $16 is nothing. But for the working classes of Queens and Rockland County, this is a very substantial cost. So what do you say to this kind of populist critique of congestion pricing?
Well, the analysis has been done. The numbers are in about the progressive nature of congestion pricing, that the vast majority of working people in the city don't drive into the central business district. They may drive from Brooklyn to Queens or, you know, on a weekend they may take a trip around and, you know, go to the Bronx or go to the mall in Westchester or, you know, what have you. But they're not driving into the central business district every day. That is being done by people of above average income or a certain privileged class of municipal workers, especially uniformed services, who get free parking, which is another piece that needs to be going after, you know, whether it's under the Kiel plan or the mayor's plan, it needs to be going after.
Yeah, it seems like cops get free parking on the precinct streets, don't they?
Yeah, and on the sidewalks of, you know, Chinatown and every other place. So, you know, I mean, this is scandalous and wrong and needs to be dealt with aside from the success of congestion pricing. But Doug, the fascinating thing that I'm seeing in the response so far to the Kiel plan, and it's just been out for a few days and it's only a preliminary version, and so, you know, it'll take time to filter in, is the timidity of, I guess you could say, people like us, of people who understand the negative impact of the automobile, who understand the progressive nature of making public transit cheap or free, who understand the sustainability issues, but who I think have been so conditioned by decades of fighting for any scrap of revenue that can be fed into the transit system and keep it functioning, that they're kind of scared off by this bold, radical vision. It's almost, you know, to make an analogy, like the environmentalists who are scared off by a carbon tax because it's too perfect. It's too much the thing at the edge of their ability to conceive. So it's going to be interesting going forward in the next few months to make this Kiel vision a reality, not just among working people who will be its natural constituents, but among the so-called environmentalists, the good government people who need to get on the bandwagon and push this.
Well, I'm certainly not scared, but I think this is terrific stuff. Thanks for doing it, Charlie. Thanks for all the stuff you've done over the years along these lines. And people who want to read the study, where can they get it on the web?
You know, the easiest thing is to just Google Kiel plan. And Kiel is spelt not like the part of a boat, but K-H-E-E-L. If you just Google Kiel plan, you'll get to Ted Kiel's Nurture New York's Nature website, and you'll get the summary of the report and a spreadsheet for those who are inclined. You can design your own pricing system. And maybe there's a better balance between the car and transit than the one that we've cooked up so far. Go for it.
All right. Thanks, Charlie. I've been speaking with Charlie Komenoff, who is an economist and environmentalist who's done many things, good things to help us rein in the car and liberate us all. Let's take a break for station ID, and we'll be back in a little bit to hear from Adolf Reed.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is WBAI. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And we're not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but we're also on the web at WBAI.org. And do check out the website. Let's take a musical break, and then I'll be back to introduce Adolf Reed.
Got no need for the fancy things. All the attention that it brings. Tell me no.
And that was a bit of Santo Gold, who is a Brooklyn-based singer and all-around musical artist. That's a bit of her song, Creator. She's a good pal of MIA, who is a Sri Lankan, British DJ, singer, composer, performer, whose stuff I played the past couple of weeks. So great stuff. I love that. It is the political season now, and I was at a party the other night, and somebody asked, who's your candidate? And I guess that's the common thing now. And it just happened that I came across Adolf Reed's column in the November issue of the Progressive magazine on why he's sitting this one out. And I thought it was worth asking Adolf why he's not going to go for this. He's not going to be seduced by this game of picking a candidate this year. Adolf is a professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania and, as I said, contributor to the Progressive magazine. Adolf Reed.
So it seems like every time I go to a party these days, people ask me, who's your candidate? You don't seem to have one this year. Are you sitting it out?
Yep, that's right. I don't have one. As I just recently said, if Edwards continues to sound the way that he's been sounding, and if he can survive and get the nomination, I might be tempted, depending on how things shape up between the conventions and the election, to go vote for him. But apart from that, I'm just going to sit this one out. And between now and then, I'm frankly barely paying any attention. I suppose I shouldn't even say this out loud as a practicing political scientist, but I'm hardly paying any attention to the horse race aspects of this thing at all, actually. It just seems quite beside the point, finally.
I hadn't planned to ask this question, but what does your profession as a practicing political scientist, does this bring you any insight into the electoral process, or is it just years of actual involvement in political work that has led you to these conclusions?
Frankly, I think it's much more the latter than the former, right? I think the former is pretty useless, except for predicting what's already happened. I mean, here's the situation. I think the Democrats are most likely to nominate a version of what they've nominated since Dukakis every 4 years, and it's as likely as not to have the same outcome, which is to produce a candidate who, if they're lucky, gets someplace around 49% of the vote. If it's Clinton or Obama, then it's going to be a candidate who has already indicated during the primaries that they're more concerned with running to appease the people who aren't inclined to vote for them, and with triangulating than they are with standing for anything, right? They're two ostensibly anti-war candidates, both of whom think the best way to oppose the war is by expanding it and extending it. They both have comparatively lame versions of the same overall lame approach to the healthcare crisis. As far as I can see, neither of them has had very much to say about the need to rebuild crumbling infrastructure in the country, physical or social. So, I just don't quite see what the point is. Now, I know, and of course, as I said in my Progressive column, the argument from either of those candidates and all the other loyal Dems is going to be that the other guy's worse, whoever the other guy is, that the dangers of Republican victory are so great that we just need to hold our noses and enthusiastically get behind whatever Democrat runs, you know, runs, no matter whether they win or without regard to whatever they might promise and whatever entanglements they have. So, you know, here we go again. And you know, after so many versions of the dance, I just lost my taste for it. And frankly, I mean, it's not purely an existential matter. I just think that as long as we, by we, I mean you know, all of us who you know, would like to see something, something that arguably looks like social democratic reform, as long as we you permit them, first of all, to insist that the limits of our political aspirations should be tied to quadrennial prep, to the biennial congressional races and the quadrennial presidential politics, and secondly, that the limits of our political aspirations should be confined to their notion of the realpolitik at the moment, whether or not it addresses anything that the vast majority of us are actually concerned about, then we're never going to get anywhere.
Now, is it being too kind to the Democrats to say they don't actually stand for anything? It seems to me that they may actually stand for being loyal servants of money and imperial power, and they sometimes have to pretend otherwise, but aren't they actually loyal servants of the status quo?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it does give them way too much credit to suggest that they don't stand for anything. I mean, I think that they're, you know, that they are, you know, the sort of happy-faced version of the GOP. I mean, I was reminded just last night that it was, among other things, Bill Clinton who was the auteur of the claim that Saddam Hussein was stockpiling weapons of mass destruction. Even and you know, that's not to even get to the other ways that his administration, which is everybody's model now for what a democratic success is what you know, gave us, you know, so-called welfare reform and the destruction of the federal government's commitment to direct provision of housing for the poor. And as you pointed out, it was the Clinton administration that created and undid the dot-com bubble, and I guess was around, at least partly implicated for the beginning of the housing bubble. No, you're quite right. I mean, that's, you know, I think it makes the most sense to see this as a Janus-faced corporate and investor class party, I should say.
There was an interesting piece in the New Republic a couple of months ago arguing that Hillary's vote for the Iraq War was not just based on political calculation, but she actually is a big fan of the military and the projection of imperial power. So, again, that's giving her too much credit to think it was calculation.
Yeah, well, frankly, I mean, that's been my sense of what her approach to foreign policy is, right? I mean, I know that her apologists have been saying ever since she first ran for Senate in New York that she has to appear hawkish because, well, she doesn't have a Y chromosome. And in the absence of a Y chromosome, then you've really got to swing where the outward appendage of the Y chromosome would be if it were there, you know, to prove that you're man enough as a woman to enact a muscular foreign policy. But whatever the reason is, you know, the fact of the matter is that her entire public career has been one linked, well, she could be, you know, Scoop Jackson, frankly.
She tried to join the Marines when she was in college, but they rejected her for two reasons. One, she wore glasses, and two, she is a woman.
Well, yeah. No comment.
This Janus face business has long historical roots, doesn't it?
It's like the line of the moderate segregationist in the Smith v. Albright when blacks were able to vote again in some numbers. You know, they'd always say, well, I can't do anything for you, and I have to call you bad names and race bait you when I'm speaking to white audiences, but you ought to understand, I don't really mean it, and besides, the other guy's worse. And that's basically what they're saying to all of us, you know, left of center in the Democratic Party. And, I mean, this time, just like in 04 and 2000 and 96 and 92, we can even look at the primary season and see that you know, left interests, it feels, to tell you the truth, increasingly brutally and bluntly marginalized in the process, and I don't mean just by candidates like Kucinich and even Edwards and earlier on Harkin just being defined as fringe from the very beginning, but I mean by the party hack's insistence that no substantive issues can be raised that during the debates or at campaign stops that the putatively leading candidates feel uncomfortable with. Right, which means you know no issues that might tick off the Christian right or whoever else you would be disinclined to be, you know, to vote for them, it's pretty extraordinary. And I'll say this, you know, speaking as a political scientist, that, you know, we all know that whenever they're going to talk to us, it's during the primary season. And if this is the best that we can get from them now, then what the hell would lead anybody to believe that after whichever one of these losers gets a nomination, that they're going to do anything other than you know, run to the right, run even farther to the right.
Now, what about the possibility, and this is in my darkest, most pessimistic moments, I say that the problem really isn't with the Democrats or the candidates, but the American public just doesn't, or not very much more than 10 or 20% of it, shares our kinds of politics. And so this is just a reflection of the way things are. And until that changes, this is what we have to live with.
Well, you know what, Doug? I mean, that could be the case, right? And that's the, you know, I would put the number at a little higher than that. But I think that that's the one sense in which the Democratic apologists have a point about the electoral stuff. For any given election, the terms of debate are set in such a way that you know, left-of-center initiatives just can't even get off the ground. And that's one of the reasons that I think, for instance, that the pursuit of third-party candidacies is, you know, ultimately a waste of time, or if it's considered to be more than an existential statement, a way of thumbing one, you know, one's nose at the process, it's a waste of time, because you can't get anywhere doing that. You can't build a movement doing that, and there's no chance that any third-party candidate under these conditions is going to get anywhere. So what it comes down to, and this is precisely the reason that I'm planning to sit this thing out, is that the only option that you have really is to vote on terms that are just themselves ultimately unacceptable, right? It's a lose-lose proposition. Where I think the left bears a lot of responsibility, bears the most responsibility, is for not concentrating on trying to build a constituency for our kind of politics between elections, right? I mean, you know, I keep going back to this, but the right got its clock cleaned in 64 with Goldwater, and the lesson that one of the lessons that they took from that defeat was that their political agenda was too far outside the common sense of the mainstream of American political discourse. And what they needed to do was to pull back, dig in, organize from the bottom up, as well as from the top down, for the long term, to create a constituency around issue bundles that would give them a majoritarian alliance. That's what the left has just been incapable of doing for whatever reason. And that's what we need to do.
I'm speaking with Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. What about the inevitable riposte you're going to get from your average liberal, that the costs are just too high of letting the other guys win, and it may hurt, but just hold your nose and pull the lever because we're just one vote away from abortion being illegal, or you know the litany of horrors. What do you say to that standard argument?
My initial response is one that we can't use on the air. After I make that response by way of explanation, you know, my response is that the costs are too great for whom? You know, I think, you know, that there's a sort of, I'm not sure what the best analogy is, but there's kind of a logical sleight of hand going on here where first the liberals condense every woman's concern with American politics to the status of formal access to abortion as a right, without respect to how it's connected to the healthcare system, without respect to how it's connected to labor market segmentation, comparable worth, employment discrimination, you know, no access to daycare, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, I mean, one of the ironies I find, you know, about this too, is that symbolic attachment to choice, because nobody's really fighting for abortion rights anymore, at least not the liberals, but symbolic access to choice as the sine qua non of women's concerns with politics, allegedly, coincides with a resurgent pronatalism in the same class fraction that elevates motherhood to a pedestal that it probably hasn't been on in the Western world since the fall of National Socialism. And then even the advocates of a choice on the liberal side, opened by saying that they hoped that there would never be No woman would ever feel a need to have an abortion, but the right should be there. I guess my point is that this last shred of the bloody flag that they wave for us is so tiny, so shriveled, and remote a concern for the lives in everyday lives of most women even, that the argument just doesn't seem to be that compelling. I think you say the same thing about affirmative action or civil rights enforcement or environmental protection, because at every step along the way, once in power, the Democrats have been ceding ground, as they go along, even both in Congress and in the 8 years that we had Clinton in the White House. And frankly, I think we might be better able to fight against the direct rightist attack on reproductive rights than to have the cloudier kind of discourse with the Democrats in power, who'd be explaining to us about how they got to make compromises with the likes of Trent Lott because he's a decent one you can talk to, and this, that, and the other.
Now, let's return to the what goes on in politics between elections. We've had a very large portion of the American public, it depends upon how the polls are worded or when they're taken, but a very large portion of the American public has turned pretty strongly against the war in Iraq. Yet the anti-war movement can't go anywhere, and the Democrats in Congress can't do anything to either shut off the funding or bring the troops home. What's happened with the anti-war movement? Do you have any diagnosis of why that has just been so utterly ineffective, even though the public opinion is at least open, perhaps widely open to an appeal?
Well, Doug, I tell you, that's a really good question, and I think quite a head-scratcher. I mean, I've been trying to get a handle on this for several years. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the anti-war movement itself has gotten trapped in an event-driven approach to politics. That that is to say, that instead of trying to figure out ways to broaden bases of support at the local level, or to concentrate more effort on trying to broaden bases of support in neighborhoods, workplaces, etc., it just feels to me like the center of gravity of anti-war activism lies too much in the direction of building for public statement, mass moves, and the sense that at some point, massing bodies on the Mall in D.C. or at Union Square or Central Park or San Francisco or wherever is going to send a message to Congress and to the administration that the war has to end. That's a modality of expression of opposition that's just passé at this point. I mean, they don't care. I mean,
it sends the message that you can gather thousands of people to stand around in perhaps unpleasant weather and listen to boring speeches.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And probably, the last smart thing that Todd Gitlin did in his 1980 book, The Whole World is Watching, the mass media and the making and unmaking of the new left, was right on target about that, I think, that the logic of the mass rally appeals to people who participate in it, partly because it's familiar, but the familiarity is precisely what undercuts its effectiveness. I mean, you think about the Seattle WTO demonstrations. I mean, they caught everybody by surprise, even the demonstrators, and that was great. But the problem is, if you're only going to catch the ruling class by surprise like that once, and the next time we're going to be prepared for it. And I guess I got into this a little bit in the column too. The idea that our protest activity has come to has fallen into a comfortable groove that I've been calling the permit regime. So we have the demonstrations on the condition that we don't disrupt anything, and we accept march routes that aren't any more disruptive than a homecoming parade. We don't engage with anybody who's not part of the demo. We allow ourselves to be marched down to some obscure or inaccessible area where we don't see anybody except one another, and then we listen to those speeches. I mean, I don't go to those things anymore. I just, sometimes, like in honor of the moment, in the shower, I will, on that morning, I will give the speeches in the shower. As I look out on this sea of faces today, black, white, old, young, gay, straight, male, female, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then everybody feels good about themselves and they go home. I think another problem, too, is a tendency to exaggerate the potential of what they're calling now e-activism, and I know.
Yeah, that's activism you can commit by not even leaving your desk chair.
Exactly. That's precisely that kind of activism. And I think that's one thing that's made it tough for us. I mean, people, and, you know, Doug, I mean, I think, too, this is, you know, yet another expression of what happens to a movement after three decades of steady defeat. But a lot of people have come to think that being on the left means being really, really well informed. So, and by the way, hardly ever talking to people who don't already agree with you or trying to figure out how to talk to them in some way other than by tacking the theses on the chapel door. And, you know, that's the kind of organizing approach that I think we need to cultivate. I mean, I don't despair at the possibility that even only 20% of the population is open to our kind of politics now. That's a challenge. You know, I think that our view of the world is correct, and that if we can find a way to communicate it effectively to people, there will be a lot more of us than there are of them. I know a lot of lefties, you know, go on and on about, you know, the manifold advantages that the right has with, you know, respect to being so well-funded and this, that, the other. But one big advantage, or one big disadvantage that they have that we don't, is that our politics isn't built on selling people a bill of goods and convincing them that the reason that they don't have any health care is because gay people can get married. So, I mean, that's a big advantage for us. And, you know, I think that it's possible. And, look, I realize this is in the act of faith, but that's sort of what politics is. I mean, it has to be any way you're going to go someplace. You know, but I've got to think that it's possible for us to build an alliance that's broad enough, even among Americans, for all of, you know, the limitations of people in this country. I mean, as you pointed out, like in other contexts, it's not like, you know, there's a utopia anyplace else either. Whether or not it's possible to build an alliance, you know, like that, to cultivate, you know, a real base for an alternative political discourse and the program, I don't see where we have any alternative but to try and to make that the priority. And see, this is another problem that I've got with the institutions of the left of center, and I guess, you know, the labor movement here is key, that it's got to be possible to do two things at once, right? I mean, for people who are inclined to work to get whichever you know, neoliberal weasel gets the Democratic nomination this time elected, fine. You know, I will accept that there could be some marginal difference between, you know, that weasel and the Republican. And if you feel that's important to do that, fine. But it should be possible to focus yourself, you know, to focus some resources and political energy on that stopgap activity of trying to stanch the bleeding, while at the same time putting a little something, you know, in, you know, into the objective of trying to build for the longer haul in a way that's not constrained by, you know, by the election cycle. And it's, I find it astounding, but frankly, in sociological terms, or how much of our movement is incapable, seems incapable of you know, recognizing or taking in the implications of the fact that the nature of the game has changed, that the old social management regime has broken down and can't be, you know, replaced. Actually, the same friend who's the author of the "We'll Come Back to You" line just observed a couple of days ago that she thinks that that it's probably time that movement jobs are a big chunk of the problem, and that it's probably going to be more productive for us to think about, I mean, doing our politics on the side while holding down more conventional jobs wherever we can, because there's something about socializing effect of the movement jobs that kind of fastens people onto the small-minded and you know, defensive style of politics that always, you know, sort of leads back to having that hacks in the Democratic Party set the, you know, set the limits of the politically thinkable.
And that's Adolph Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and a columnist for the Progressive magazine. And you can read his article, Sitting This One Out, from the November issue of the Progressive on their website at progressive.org. Just follow some links to the November issue, and it's right there, available freely online. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with some more from Santo Gold. This is her song, Shove It. Till next week, bye.